We cannot let their voices stifle our cause. This political crisis puts our head in their jaws. History is upon us. We've seen this before. We can never allow freedom to exit our shore. Good afternoon and welcome to the Trump Chronicle. I'm your host, Ray Brookstein. 2 weeks ago, we spent an hour talking about the dynamics and threats to Israel, recalling that there are three major religions that intersect in this small country, a little larger than the state of New Jersey. Today, I'm continuing to talk Israel, and I've re-invited my guest on again. Yanky Farber is a native Israeli, an activist, and a news reporter who lives in Israel where he was born and bred. Alana Friedman is an international intelligence analyst who also hosts an incredible news magazine on Wednesday on America Out Loud, but she also lived in Israel for 16 years. So welcome back, Yanky and Ilana.
Yeah. Hi, welcome.
I'm here as well. Thank you.
Yanky, I want to get the ball rolling here because it appears that the latest news coming out of Israel and in the media is very serious. Please tell us what happened on the ground this past week and what's going on.
Okay. So Israel, again, had a big, a big fight. We had a war with Gaza. Nobody really knows how it started, but usually one of the Hamas, one of the people in Gaza, just sending one or two rockets out. And then Israel fires back, and then each one fires on each one. Basically, they fired on the Israelis 650 rockets in 2 days.
My God.
Four people were killed. Now, the thing is, people don't understand that in Israel, there is also a lot of Muslims who live and they are part of Israel. They have all the rights. We call them Israeli Arabs. And they vote, they work, they doctors, they everything. Now, one of the guys was killed was a religious Jew. The other guy that was killed was a non-religious Jew. And then there was another guy that is not even Jewish, is a Bedouin, a Muslim Bedouin, that he was killed. And then there was another guy that was killed. So basically, people don't really make a difference if he's religious, if he's not religious, if he's Jewish. We count Israelis as equal, everyone. And anyway, so 650 rockets flying all over Israel, four people died. In Gaza, the Palestinians, of course, send pictures, fake pictures, which have been taken from Syria, from Lebanon, from Iraq, from wherever they are, and they've been posting it all over saying that Israeli army killed the Palestinian babies. That was a lie. That's not true. And because the Israeli army is making sure that they're not arming any place that kids or anything going on. And let me tell you, a lot of times Israel were going to shoot one of the Hamas leaders, and in the last second, the pilot did not shoot the rocket because there were kids running around in that place.
I wanted to talk about restraint, because sometimes it seems that when the enemy launches an attack and they never get condemned, but it appears that when Israel responds, they get condemned. And now you're saying that there were photographs and so on and so forth. So you're saying that the Israeli pilot showed restraint. Is this a true statement?
Yeah, and the IDF also announced a statement that the babies that the Palestinians said that they were killed, but not from the Israeli Air Force or anything. They were killed by their own rockets. Hamas sent rockets, and by mistake, the rocket fell in Gaza, in a Palestinian house, and they killed a pregnant woman, a mother with a baby, and another child. So, and then the Palestinians said that Israelis killed them. Now, the IDF proved that was a lie. And it happens all the time. Now, the reason it happens all the time, everybody says it in Israel, this is something that we're trying to fight, but it's like impossible. The Palestinian people have help from all over the world. Every country in the world except America and beside a few people like Ian Omar or maybe Rashida Tlaib, people in the world always believe the Palestinian because Israel is a strong country. So when you have these Palestinians, you know, crying over the TV or video that Israelis are doing this or doing that, and then you see tanks and you see airplanes and you see massive army. So obviously you're going to go with the Palestinian side because you don't really know what's happening now. One of the things the Israeli people are fighting is over social media. Social media is full with pictures and videos and fake news and lies and wrong information about Israel. This is something that sometimes we lose. This is the place where Israel keeps losing all the time, social media. Well, I'm trying my best. A lot of my friends are trying our best. But this is like a drop in the sea. Yeah, but one thing, the amount of money the Palestinian people have to spread information, wrong information all over the world is billions. Mm. I don't know who is giving them the money, but this is how they win.
You know, I did notice you put up a tweet and you asked for people to retweet it 2,000 times.
Yeah.
How did that work?
Yeah. No, it didn't work well. I only got about 600. No, okay. It doesn't work on Twitter. No, it's fine.
You're not upset.
No. I should have done 1,000, but because 1,000 is okay. But I did 2,000. I don't know why. I didn't check really because I'm doing it for fun. I'm not really. No, but I when I post a good video or a picture or trying to explain the situation, I do have probably sometimes like I check afterwards. 20,000, 30,000, sometimes even 100,000 people are reading it. So it's good. Well, it's not only to get other people to know the truth. It's also to keep the people who support us to keep supporting us. It's also important to keep our base.
Yes. And Ilana, from your knowledge of what's going on right now, what do you think precipitated this particular event?
Well, it's difficult to say because this happened very suddenly, and on early Saturday morning, suddenly a lot of rockets, tens and 20 and 30 and 40 and 100 rockets came all at once, and they kept coming. So it's difficult to say where it starts, but I have a theory that supports something that Yanky said, which is my theory is called first story out wins. Why does Hamas get so much leverage from their story and Israel gets so little from theirs? And the reason is that Hamas, before anything happens, has their story ready. And by the time there's something going on, that story's already in the news and it's their slant. It's their, you were talking about photographs before. Among the photographs that came out of dead people, believe it or not, they used a photograph from the Holocaust. And they said that showed what Israel had done to Gaza. And this is what Israel is fighting against, but they get their story out first, and that's the story that people believe because they see the pictures, they hear the story, and there is no response right away. And so there is this momentum from the initial first story out, and that's the one that people remember. And that's why Israel has such a PR problem.
So we're talking about not only just physical warfare, Yanky, we're talking about psychological warfare, aren't we?
Yeah, this is something that a lot of people try to change. It's like fighting against to something very strong of you. I don't see a solution unless someone is going to put a lot of money into it. And but we live like this, we fight like this, and we survive like this. I don't know what to do or what to say, but I'm trying my best by myself with a whole bunch of friends. By the way, there's a lot of Israeli organizations who fight all over the world, like Stand With Us or the Israel Project and some other guys, big guys. But this is like, as I said, a drop in the sea. The Hamas, they have so much money. Now, this is something funny because they keep blaming Israel that Israel is putting Gaza under siege. They have no food, no water, no electricity. So if they don't have all these things, why are they putting money in terror tunnels? Why are they investing in weapons, in rockets? Why are they not taking the money that they're getting from European Union and from all over the world and building hotels, swimming pool, clubs? They didn't take Gaza after Israel left Gaza and made it paradise. Gaza is a very nice place. the money they have for the people, they spend in investing in rockets. So they're not poor. They have a lot of money. They just want to destroy Israel. That's it. And we're not going to let them.
It's more than just what Yanky is saying. It's not that they are let me say this. Hamas is misusing the billions of dollars that they have received in humanitarian aid. They siphon off the money they want. They use it to build tunnels, to buy weapons, and so forth. And that's on the one hand. On the other hand, they refuse to invest it in infrastructure in Gaza. So for just one quick example, when they took over in 2007, there were five operative sewage disposal plants in Gaza, and they were more or less operating. By now, none of the these things constantly need maintenance and repairs, and they weren't done. They are all offline now, and every day Gaza pumps 200 million gallons of raw sewage into the Mediterranean.
Oh my God.
Do you understand the magnitude of their neglect? And what happens when Yanky says they don't have electricity? It's because the power plants aren't working properly. And Gazans have maybe 2 hours. So what do they do when it gets really, really hot in the summer? They go swimming in the ocean with all the solid, you know, with all the sewage.
So, Yanky, are we seeing this as the beginning of another active war engagement in the coming months?
Yes, and I'll tell you why. The Israeli media, but the media that I trust, I mean, we also have the MSM, you know, the mainstream media that we don't trust. We do trust. But the Israeli media that I do trust said that the reason why Netanyahu stopped the war with Gaza is not because Israeli things. It's because it has to do with American and Iran. Iran threatening to attack American soldiers in all over the whatever, in the water maybe, or I don't really know exactly, but this is what they are threatening to arm American soldiers. It's not a big problem. You have American soldiers in Syria, you have American soldiers in Iraq, you have American soldiers in other places. So the reason why Israel stopped is because something is going on between America and Iran. Nobody knows. And
so there's a ceasefire right now.
Israel, yes, but America asked Israel to stop the war. This is what the Israeli media is saying. I don't have a proof for it, but this is what they're saying. I think that in a week or two or three, it's going to happen again, but this time it's going to be big. Israel is going to fight like there's no tomorrow. This is going to be the one last big fight.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, nothing you can do.
Oh, my goodness. So right now we're in a ceasefire.
Yeah, this is like a ceasefire, and Hamas is saying that Israel promised a few things to do for them, and Israeli said, no, it didn't promise anything. Nobody really knows exactly who promised to. Now, the Egyptian, Egypt are doing a very good job. That I can say. Egypt are working very hard all the time to stop, to, you know, the old Hamas. They tell Hamas, if you do this, we're not going to let you in. We're not going to let you out. They're working very hard. I don't know what's going on behind. You know, so many times people say, why Netanyahu is not attacking Gaza? Why Netanyahu is not attacking Gaza? And I'm saying people who support Netanyahu. And then a week later, people realize that we discovered like 6 or 7 tunnels in the north with the Hezbollah. So we had to fight Hezbollah first. The reason why Israel is not doing things, or maybe are doing things, is because sometimes we don't know. We only find out a week later, 2 months later. So we're just going to have to wait. At the moment, this is a ceasefire.
What do the people want, in your estimation?
Okay, so it turns like this. The lefties, obviously, they want Israel to build a Palestinian state. No way. Netanyahu will never do it, because they're going to put the Jewish state in a danger. Mm-hmm. And the right people, the people who voted for Netanyahu, wanted Netanyahu to keep attacking Gaza. But this is something that both agree, the left and the right, even the right, they don't want dead soldiers. Oh. They don't want Israel to go in again to Gaza and try to conquer Gaza, because nobody wants to have dead soldiers. This is something that we don't want to accept anymore. So they won't keep shooting Gaza, you know, with the Air Force. Well, you cannot win Hamas with an Air Force. You need to get into Gaza and start going house by house, like Israel did 15 years ago in Jenin, went house by house, and they emptied the place from weapons. And that's where Israel is. So that's why it's quiet in Jenin and all these places. Mm-hmm. In Ramallah, Jenin, and this is something nobody wants. I support Netanyahu big time, and I can say that I don't want dead soldiers, because unless there's a solution, because, you know, to go into Gaza, fight a whole month, get 150, 200 soldiers dead, another 500 injured, and civilians all over Israel are getting injured from the rockets, and then what? We're going to go back to the first place? So just people die and people get killed, and there's no solution. There's no, if Israel decides we going to take over Gaza, as long as it takes a month, 3 months, 4 months, this is a different story. But just to fight for a month or two and soldiers die, nobody wants people to die, and unless you have to. But if you don't have to, Netanyahu said on Israeli media a few times just before the election, and this is what he said: I am not going to send any soldier to die unless I made sure that I did everything I could not to send the soldiers in die. If I have to send, I'm going to send, but I'm going to do everything not to have families losing their children. This is Israel. This is what, it's very, very complicated to understand, but this is what we're going through here.
Wow. Now, you mentioned the Israeli election, which was just about a month ago. Does this have anything to do with that? Has a government been formed in Israel? I know it's a unique situation, what happens in Israel versus how we have elections in the United States. What did this have anything to do with the recent election and the formation of the government?
No, I don't think so, because at the end of the day, the right, the left, they all go to the army, they all serve the same place. They maybe said a bit, the people who were voting against Netanyahu said Netanyahu is not doing anything, he's not working the right way with Gaza. So when they've been asked, okay, so what are you going to do with Gaza? So they said, yeah, we're also going to do what he's doing, but he's been doing it for a long time. So people said, I don't understand, why do you want to replace him? You don't have a different plan. So we're not gonna vote for you. The lefties got together a few parties and made 35 seats. They're not gonna be in the government because Netanyahu has all the other right parties with him. So they just united together. By the way, most of the lefties in Israel stopped being lefties. They moved to the center because the left failed. And one of the reasons they failed, because as I said last time, they're not getting married. They're not making babies. They're not doing anything to be big. They're just getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And I can say that maybe next election, Meretz party, very, very left-wing party, extreme left-wing party, they will not go through because they just about went through now.
You know, we worry about the left here, that they're gaining momentum. But some of the same things are happening. They're very anti-family, anti-borders, anything that Trump has done. So it's interesting, but you see the left in Israel kind of shrinking, and we see the left in America gaining, and it's one of our fears.
It's different. It's different. The Israeli lefties and the American lefties, they fight for different things. I mean, they're both lefties, but they fight for different things. The lefties in America want open border. They don't care that people are going to come from all over and destroy America. They don't care. The lefties in Israel do care about. And by the way, in America, as we said, lefties and right people will not sit together in a wedding. They're not going to speak together. They're not going to have in a restaurant. We sit all together. We laugh all together. We live together. We're just voting different than the election. That's the only thing.
It's amazing. Thank you for coming on for the first segment today. And, you know, we'd like to have you back as things on the ground continue. We're going to take a short break.
The Out Loud Perspective awaits you in life, love, politics, a healthy lifestyle, your faith, personal development, and living an out loud life on AmericaOutloud.com. Blitzer News and Entertainment Network, where you can listen 24/7 on our free apps on both Android and Apple. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Ilana, I'd like to pose a hypothetical question to you.
Okay.
Let's suppose that we were enemies of Canada. And Canada sent 650 missiles that would hit between Newark, New Jersey, and Trenton. What would be our reaction?
You know, that's the question I ask all the time, Ray. I use it to pose. I use the geography is a little different because I talk about Vermont, which is roughly the size of Israel.
Okay.
And it's actually slightly larger, I think. But in any case, it's roughly the size. And what I ask is, supposing that Vermont received almost 700 missiles and rockets and mortars in a two-day period from New Hampshire. That's how close they were talking.
Oh, my goodness.
It's not coming from way over in Canada down to New Jersey. It's Vermont and New Hampshire fighting with each other. And so what would we do then? And what, you know, the proximity is something that Americans have a great deal of difficulty understanding because we're such a big country. When we say that all of Israel is the size of Vermont, that gives you an idea. Vermont is one of our tiniest states. And so we then have a little bit of a perspective of what Israel is facing. And it, honestly, let's say it came from Canada and it went into Vermont instead of New Jersey, we would have a war on our hands.
Right.
We would reach, and it wouldn't be diplomatically. And I don't think there's any question about it. Nobody can put up with that. So I think it's very unreasonable to expect that Israel is going to, you know, sustain that for a minute. When it starts killing Israeli citizens, you know, the situation is something which is so dramatic and so obvious, and yet many Americans refuse to see it.
Do you think Israel is showing restraint in spite of all this?
Yes, absolutely. When they go in, look, Hamas sent over nearly 700 rockets, missiles, and mortars over a two-day period. When Israel went in, they had approximately 350 airstrikes. And these were targeted strikes.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't just bomb indiscriminately. They took out the headquarters of one of Hamas's command posts. They targeted a money man for Hamas who did move large amounts of money, and they targeted his car on the road. Nobody else was hurt, just the people in his car. And so, this is the way they do it. And as Yankee has said, when they see children, what Hamas does, sends children to the rooftops. So that the rooftops in that part of the world are generally flat. And so they stand on the rooftops, and they're like balconies. You know, they're like some of the apartment buildings in some of our cities.
When we go to a rooftop in New York, for example.
Exactly.
You know, that's
exactly
where people hang out.
And that's where they send the children and they send the women, and they know Israelis will not bomb them. And most of the time they won't. Unless there have been a few situations where the people who are being targeted are so powerful and so dangerous, and this is so intentional that they have been known to target occasionally, and very occasionally. Most of the time, the story that Yankee tells about the pilot who refused to fire on a place because there were children there, that's the rule. The other is the exception.
I see. And
Israelis are very, very careful about not misplacing their bombs.
What is that dome defense that people refer to? Can you enlighten our audience about this?
Iron Dome is a defensive weapon which is used. It tracks incoming missiles and rockets, and it blows them out of the sky. And it is extremely accurate. And I think the percentage of times when it hits its target is somewhere around 95%. I'm not sure of the number, but it's in that neighborhood.
Now, when you lived in Israel, and you did live in Israel for 16 years, I recall.
Yes.
Did they have shelters, underground shelters, where people can shelter in place?
Yes, they do. They have two different kinds of shelters. Public buildings have one kind of shelter. They're big rooms, and they're fortified. And if you're at a public event and there's an attack, everybody is taken down to the shelters. If you're in a restaurant, they have a shelter. But there are two kinds of shelters for the regular Israeli people. Every playground in every community has a shelter, and if you you see this, it looks like a little metal hut, but you go into it, you go downstairs, and there's a big room down there which is pretty well protected against bombs.
I see.
In houses, in people's apartments, there are also what they call security rooms. I lived in a place in a part of Jerusalem called French Hill, and every apartment in the complex that I lived in had a security room. And this is a room with a big steel door and cement supports all around in the walls. And if there is an attack in Jerusalem, that's where we would go. And these places are very, very important in Israel, because if you can remember the attacks in Gaza, when those sirens go off, they have 15 seconds to get to a shelter.
Oh, my goodness.
15 seconds.
Wow. So they're almost like when they build in Israel, this is just part of the code. These are your house, your apartment, it's all fortified because of this.
Well, and there are fortified places in it.
Yes.
The apartment buildings themselves are not necessarily fortified, but there are fortified rooms inside.
I see. So this is like, we can't even understand what it's like here in America. You know, I know I've heard about some troop movements. Not too much has been said. But, Ilana, we're seeing some naval and air force battle fleets apparently heading out towards the Mediterranean. Is there any information that can shed some light on what might be going on?
Well, there is, what happened in Gaza, or from Gaza over the weekend, what happened in Israel, it had a clear connection to Iran. Iran is funding Hamas, and it is also using Hamas as a kind of advance guard. So what the president did was, in response to several different kinds of troubling indications that Iran was getting restless, the United States deployed the USS Abraham Lincoln Carrier Strike Group,
okay,
plus a bomber task force, and they sent it to the general area called the U.S. Central Command Region.
Okay.
We don't know exactly where these guys are right now, or where they're going to, because they have not released that information. But the point is that this is sending a clear and unmistakable message to the Iranian regime. And that message is that any attack on United States interests, which includes Israel, because Israel is one of our allies in the region.
Yes.
And they will be met with unrelenting force. And this carrier strike group and the bomber task force are very well equipped to do that.
Unbelievable. I mean, it seems like this is becoming a real hot spot. And this is only happening in the last, time period. So, you know, I guess some of that money that was sent on pallets went somewhere, didn't it?
Well, yeah, it was shocking. First of all, that we sent money to Iran, that we sent cash to Iran.
Cash.
In payment for the return of our hostages. I mean, we don't do that. Obama did it.
Did we owe them money?
Kerry. No.
So payment?
It's complicated. We actually had frozen a lot of Iranian assets in the United States when they took over our embassy. And I don't know that money was ever returned. So whether this was that or whether it was something else, it was payment for, maybe it was bribe money. What Obama did during his presidency,
yes,
he did so many things that were so opposite to what America stands for. Not only negotiating with terrorists, but paying them off with huge amounts of pallets of cash, as you say. I mean, this was just what was it, 1.8 billion? I don't remember what the number was.
1.8 billion. I don't know if it was all in cash, but a lot of pallets of cash.
It was pallets of cash. And this was a horrendous breach of United States policy that had been in place for decades. And so, you know, we now have to live with the consequences of that, because some of that money went to build their nuclear capabilities. And so, even in spite of the fact that they said they weren't doing it, we know that they were. And some of it went to Hamas, and some of it went to Hezbollah. And so, you know, we know that they have misused our money. Our tax dollars have gone to terrorists.
Our money.
And it's because of our money, our tax money. And it's because of a decision that President Obama and John Kerry did, both of whom have interests in placating Iran.
I mean, we're talking about the swamp again. It's like we can't get away from the swamp, no matter which way we turn.
Not just the swamp, it's quicksand. It's just unbelievable. And the denizens of the swamp are the ones who have created this environment that we're now living in, where Congress is in chaos. We don't have a functioning Congress right now. They're so busy trying to impeach the president that they're not working. They're not doing their job. They're not getting anything done.
No, there's no legislation going on. No legislation whatsoever. It's all about obstruction. If anything, that's done.
It's all about obstruction. Yeah. And what's interesting to me is what they call projection. The Democrats are projecting the things that they did, the collusion, the obstruction of justice, all the things that they have done over the last decade, they're blaming the Republicans for. The Republicans didn't do collusion, but Hillary Clinton did. John Kerry did. The president did. And I think I'm hoping that Attorney General Barr will really go after, he says he will, I will really go after them, because this needs to be ended and it needs to be exposed and these people need to go to jail.
I mean, I really, you know, kind of thank God that the United States and Israel are allies. Because who would protect them? I mean, are the British doing anything in Israel? Are the Germans doing anything in Israel? The French? Anybody in Europe? I mean, is there some help that's going on? Or is it just Israel alone and the United States with an assist? Who are the other players in this area?
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting because some of the players are Arab states who are newly, how can I say this? They're becoming more friendly to Israel because they see that their interest, technologically, Israel is way ahead of most of the world.
Yes.
And it's in the Arabs' best interest to be involved so they can get the benefits of this. And they're starting to see it. So you're beginning to see movement in that direction. Saudi Arabia, I think, if I'm not mistaken, the Arab Emirates, but I'm not sure. But you're starting to see this. You're starting to see this movement on the part of several Arab states, and Egypt, of course. Jordan is sort of torn, but we do have Israel has a peace agreement with them, and so we'll see what happens. Right now, the big story in Israel is what is going to happen with Hamas. Mm-hmm. Because I agree with Yanki. I believe that in the next, probably the next few weeks, we are going to see something, some major explosion from Gaza. And Hamas is just regrouping. They do this all the time. They make they sent almost 700 rockets into Israel, and then they cried for a ceasefire.
Who's supplying them with rockets?
Iran. And Doha, I think Doha just sent them $400 million. I'm not clear on the numbers. I should have done my homework better. But at least, you know, they sent them a pallet of money. And this is, and what do they do with this money, by the way? Do they help the people of Gaza? You know, I use that example of the sewage treatment plants.
Yes.
I use it because it so graphically describes how little Hamas cares for the people of Gaza. Doesn't bother them that they haven't, you know, fixed the sewage plant so that the people don't have to swim in raw sewage to get out of the heat. But what they've done, and when they get this money, it goes to their fighters. It goes to pay big salaries to their commanders. It goes to build tunnels. And right now, Israel is putting up a very, very strong defense against the tunnel. So they're looking for another way to spend this money. But they're not giving it to the people of Gaza. And that's the point. The people of Gaza are not benefiting from this. They're just suffering.
What about walls? Can you shed light on the walls that are in Israel, you know, and contrast it to what we're trying to do on our southern border?
Well, it's actually very similar, because most of what they call walls are really fences. And they're chain link fences with a lot of very, very high tech equipment on them, so that they can't, it's very, very difficult to breach them. And generally speaking, there are frequently two fences with a space in between them where jeeps, for example, can drive and see if anybody's walked over the sand that's in between the two fences. There are walls mostly in cities where people are positioned to be able to fire into apartment buildings on the other side. Israel is very hilly, and so the houses are built on hills, and so when there is no, you know, when the hill is high and you can see over a wall into another place or over a fence, you want to have something solid, and that's where there are walls. But there is a community, for example, in Jerusalem, which is near an Arab village, and they are constantly subject to attacks by, you know, random attacks, firings into apartments. And there is a wall there, and to a certain extent, it protects them. But it doesn't protect them completely, because the other side is a hill, and that side is, and the Israeli side is a hill. And so these apartments are exposed.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back with Alana Friedman.
Patriots. Through his widely acclaimed poetry books, The Trump Chronicle, Ray Ray has preserved for us these historic events that have surrounded the first 2 years of the Trump presidency. His fervent and patriotic poems capture in real time what could have easily been lost or forgotten. The Trump Chronicle is available on Amazon or through the America Out Loud bookstore. Pick up a few of these memorable books for your library. They are a must-have for our MAGA movement. Let's support this important patriotic poet and show host so we can continue to read history through poetry.
Okay, welcome back. I'm with Alana Friedman. We're continuing on what's going on in Israel. You know, Alana, we never talked in the last 2 weeks ago about the relationship between Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu. You live there. He's been, a part of Israel's parliament for quite some time. Can you tell us about their relationship as you see it?
Well, it's a very interesting relationship. When I first understood that there was something special going on between Donald Trump and Bibi Netanyahu, I thought I had heard that they had known each other from when they were younger, and Bibi was in the United States. But when you asked me to talk about this, I did some research, and I couldn't find any documentation about that. Bibi spent two periods of his life in the United States. The first one, his father was a professor in Philadelphia, and so he lived in Philadelphia for several years as a teenager. And then later on in his life, a little bit later, he came back, went to Boston, and he went to MIT, where he got an advanced degree in two things, architecture and engineering, I think. It was my understanding that somehow during this period he had met Donald Trump, but I don't know because I could not find any references to it at all. What I do know is that from the time Donald Trump became president And Bibi Netanyahu was, of course, already the prime minister of Israel. They were close and friendly, and they had a warm relationship. And at one point, I think they were probably talking on the phone at least once a week.
Wow.
To each other. which is awesome, because if you can remember just a few years ago when Obama was president and Bibi Netanyahu came to the White House, he was asked to come in the back door, not through the front portico. And he was, they had a meeting, and then Obama told Netanyahu that they would not be having a press conference, which was standard. And then he went off to have lunch and left Netanyahu sitting there, and he had to leave again by the back door. This was so contrary to the protocol of the president of the United States meeting with the leader of another nation. It was so abysmally rude and uncalled for. And I can't even think of adjectives that properly describe it. Obama was gauche and rude. I mean, it was terrible. And we were shocked. We were all shocked because we couldn't believe that the prime minister of a sovereign nation would be treated so poorly. And at one time, I think they finally gave, in one meeting, they gave lunch, but it wasn't kosher, so they couldn't eat it.
It was a real slap in the face. What do you think is behind that? What's going on? What was going on? Where was the angst in this relationship between Obama and Bibi?
I think that Obama is a Islamophile. Mm-hmm. I think he really prefers the Muslims, and he takes their position that Israel is the aggressor and needs to be removed from the face of the earth. I really think he believes that. Look who his closest advisor was, an Iranian. She was like his shadow.
Valerie Jarrett.
Valerie Jarrett. And she was his guiding light. She was the one who advised him, and almost, he said he never made a decision without her. And you know, we saw what happened in Benghazi. He walked away and went to bed, and these men were dying. The things that happened on his watch are so despicable. And then, as you mentioned, you know, the delivery of $1 billion or almost $2 billion to Iran in pallets of cash. All the things that, the only good thing that I think he did is in this area was the assassination of Osama bin Laden. That was a good thing. The rest of it just falls deep, deep, deep into the swamp.
Unbelievable. Contrast Donald Trump.
Okay, so by contrast, Donald Trump reaches out to Bibi Netanyahu, and they come together, they meet very early on. Donald Trump goes to Israel and meets there. Donald Trump moves, he does what no president for the last 20 some odd years, who every candidate has promised to do it, nobody did it. But Donald Trump moved the United States Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which has always been Israel's capital for thousands of years, but certainly now, since 1948, and when Israel became a sovereign nation on its own after the British left. In 1948. So he moved the embassy. He declared after, you know, since 1967, when Israel took over, and this is interesting, they took over the Golan Heights because they conquered Syria, the part of Syria that overlooks all of northern Israel. And they were continually firing down on and sending rockets down onto Katusha rockets, down onto Israel from there. And I can tell you personally, because I worked on a kibbutz in the valley underneath these mountains, and we were continually being fired upon. So Israel took over in 1967 in the Six-Day War, and they went up to the Golan. And you know what they found up there? They found the remnants, the remains of 34 synagogues that had been there from hundreds of years, from thousands of years. I say we, because I'm also an Israeli. I'm an American, but I'm also an Israeli. We went back to Golan, and it was like coming home. We've always been there. Jews have always been in the Golan since biblical times. So it was not that. It was the maneuvering of the European nations when they divided up the Middle East, and they gave that to the French in Syria. So anyway, that's the relationship between, getting back to what you asked me, the relationship between Donald Trump and Bibi Netanyahu made that happen. It also was influential in the re-election of Bibi Netanyahu for an unprecedented fifth term as prime minister, because of his relationship with Trump and the amount of support that Israel is now getting from Israel. Israel is now getting from the United States. And it's enormous. Now what we're looking at is a peace treaty that Donald Trump is going to come out. He said he would do it after the elections. Now we're talking maybe the middle of June. We don't know when it's going to come out, but I think it is going to be revolutionary. It's not going to be like anything that was offered before.
Do you see hope?
I always see hope. I think once we lose hope, we lose the value of our lives. And so from my point of view, hope is just a constant in our lives, and we have to constantly strive to make to create a positive outcome, where even when things seem the most dismal and dim and unhopeful. You know, in the Holocaust, the amount of tragedy was just unbearable. And yet, one of the things that came from this terrific, tremendous tragedy was the state of Israel and a home for the Jews, where they had never had one before. Well, they had had them before, but they'd been driven out over and over again. Now it's time for the Jews to stay in Israel. This should be their eternal home.
You know, sometimes I wonder, when the UN passed their resolution in 48, and they gave Israel this small bit of land that was basically sand, and maybe they thought it was a joke. You know, let's stick them here in the middle of the desert. But look what they have done in about 70 years. Now, did they have an Independence Day about coming up?
What Israel does is very interesting, because the day before Independence Day, they observe a day of mourning for all the people, for all the Jews who died in the Holocaust.
I see.
And then that night, and they do something very interesting. During the day, usually about 11 o'clock in the morning, there is a siren that sounds all over Israel, everywhere. And if you're driving in the desert and there's no siren, you stop your car and leave your radio on, because you'll hear it there. And you stop your car wherever you are, on the highway, in the middle of the city, you stop your car, you get out, and you stand next to your car in silence, in remembrance and in reverence for the people that died in the Holocaust. It's something to see, because you're driving on the highway,
and
all
stops.
Of a sudden, all the cars, everybody stops, gets out of their car, and stands in the, you know, for a moment of silence. And then, that night, it all centers around something that happens in Jerusalem. There's a mountain called Mount Herzl, where there is the cemetery for the fallen, and they have a ceremony on Mount Herzl, where they end the mourning period of mourning, the day of mourning, and they set off and they open the day of celebration for the anniversary of the independence of Israel. It's Israel Independence Day. In Hebrew, you say Yom Ha'atzmaut. Yom Ha'atzmaut. And what that means is that you go from deep mourning to celebration.
Wow.
And they send off a huge burst of fireworks that goes on for probably 15, 20 minutes. And it's awesome.
Oh, gee, it's bringing tears to my eyes, seriously.
Yeah.
Listening to you here.
In Jerusalem, along the old walls of the walls of the old city, they have a sound and light show. I think they're still doing that. And it's everything is just very dramatic. And now they have these robot lights, you know? Have you seen them?
No.
They had them at the Olympics, where they send them in the sky, and then make these patterns. Well, that's an Israeli invention. And so they have them in Israel, and and then all day long people are celebrating, and they picnic, and they have this the kids have this, what is it, this string putty that they in aerosol cans, and they spray everybody. It's crazy, but they're celebrating, and it's just a wonderful time. You can tell I really love my time in Israel. I was there for 16 years. I brought up my children there, I went over there. I was a widow when I went over there. My husband had died when he was very young. He was 32. Okay. Mm-hmm. But I brought my kids over there, and they essentially grew up in Israel and Jerusalem. It was a wonderful, wonderful time to be there.
Well, that just really was refreshing to hear that hope and joy and celebration from the morning. And it's kind of like the phoenix, isn't it? It's kind of like from the ashes. And really, go ahead.
There's something else. May I tell you something?
Please.
There was a study done recently about, and I think it's done every year, who are the happiest people in the world? Which country has the happiest people in the world? And Israel was number four, in spite of everything.
Was the U.S. the U.S. in the top three?
I don't know. But the point is that with all that's going on there, and with all the terror, and with all the tragedy, Israel is the fourth happiest country in the world. Israelis are the fourth happiest people in the world. And I understand it, because that you asked me about, is there hope?
Yes.
As long as people have this kind of relationship with their lives, there is hope.
Well, most of what I think about is children. And, we're seeing film of young Muslim children learning about jihad from very early ages. And I think it was Golda Meir that once said that when they learn to love their children, as we all love our children, I'm loosely quoting it, then that's when this conflict will end. But when children get engaged from a very young age to hate Jews, I don't think they're teaching the Israeli children to hate Arabs, are they?
Not at all. On the contrary. In fact, my children went through Israeli school. And they did not they don't teach them hatred about anybody. They teach them Bible. They teach them history. They teach them mathematics. They teach them literature. Yeah, they teach all the things that are supposed to teach in school.
it's
crazy.
Pretty simple.
You see these kids in Philadelphia, and they're no different from the kids in Gaza. Mm. These children, instead of going to summer camp, they go to military camp when they're 8 years old, and they learn how to fire a gun, and they learn how to kill Jews. That's what happens to these children in Gaza, and it's infuriating. And the United Nations has been complicit in making this happen and maintaining this. And it's so hard to believe that the United Nations, which is supposed to be an organization of peace, has contributed so much to the hatred that Arabs feel about Jews in the Middle East.
I used to go as a young, I guess, grade schooler. We used to go to the United Nations because I grew up in New York. We take a trip into the east side of Manhattan, and it was really a remarkable structure. I know you've been to the UN or you've seen the UN. It was just a tremendous glass structure right on the river. And you see all these flags from all these nations. And, there was a time that really had a luster. That was really something. It was the United Nations. And we went on field trips. We had lunch. And we went to see the General Assembly. And, there was still sort of a Cold War going on. Well, the tail end of it in the mid-60s when I was in grade school. But it's really lost it that luster, hasn't it, the UN? It's not the same.
No, it's not the same. And I don't know that it ever was, but at least at the beginning there was this illusion that that peace was going to come from this kind of amalgamation of all these different countries from around the world. But what happened, I believe, is that we expected countries which have absolutely no connection with democracy and no interest in democracy, that we invited them to be part of an organization that was established on democratic principle. So instead, it became very corrupt. It was another swamp, in fact. And you see what happens. Look, every time Israel does something or something happens in Israel, there is a censure of Israel for all kinds of horrible things, disregarding an earlier ruling against Israel, or genocide, or crimes against humanity. And Israel is the only country in the world who gets this kind of attention, the only one. And yet, of all the countries that are members of the United Nations, Israel is probably the most democratic and the fairest and the most peace-loving.
Well,
go figure.
Yeah, really. Well, I just want to wrap up. I want to thank, of course, Yankee. Well, he's not on the, here right now. Alana, your show is doing remarkable, and I hope people start to appreciate the news magazine that you're doing on a weekly basis on Wednesday. You're doing a terrific job. You're hitting all of the subjects right where they have to be. Israel, certainly, it's a complex situation that's gone on for 70 years, probably thousands of years. But as you said, and without hope, we have nothing. And I hope that we can continue to talk about Israel so that people can get a real insight, as you and Yankee are giving us, having lived there, study it, and not what we see in the news. So I want to again thank you. And on that note, love Ray Ray and a poem.